And we are live.
Welcome, everybody, to a very special episode of Strictly Casual. If you're familiar with our content, it's going to be a very similar format, but we're going to be doing something a little different. We don't normally do interviews, but our boy Luigi hooked us up with the incredible, the amazing Scott Butler. Vin?
Well, I mean, just like you said, today we have a very special guest, veteran of the video game industry with over 30 years of experience in game development. He's now working with Scopely Games on the new Avatar Pandora Rising game. But before we get into that, let's start at the beginning and introduce Scott Butler. Boom, boom, boom. Small claps.
Thank you, guys.
Everywhere.
Thank you.
Scott, thanks so much for joining us today. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself before we dive in.
Yeah, my name's Scott Butler. I'm a British video game artist, but I live in Los Angeles now. And I started a very long time ago. I was 16 when I was offered my first job. I used to go to this little computer club and show sort of like we play games and I'd show artwork and things. And I've been doing it ever since. I actually started the following year at 17 because I had to finish my exams. I was told off for coming up with crazy ideas. I'm a little too young. So I had to finish that first and then I was able to start. But yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So because you got so involved so early, that means you didn't go to uni?
No, I was at high school and I was always a dreamer. I was always sort of staring out the window, not paying attention. I've always had a big imagination and, you know, I grew up on like, you know, Star Wars and sci-fi movies and fantasy stuff. And I found school pretty boring. And while I was at school, I would sketch a lot, you know, on my exercise book, which I always got in trouble for. And when I was 16, around 15, I think I started at this club. It's a local club where you bring your, I had a Commodore Amiga back in the day, used to bring it there and, you know, everyone else was playing video games and stuff. And I was bringing artwork and sort of, you know, like mock video games. And I used to make up like shoot 'em ups, like R-Type style stuff and paint them by hand and create baddies and bad guys and stuff, you know.
Wow.
And I don't know why I did this, but it was something I did. I was very young. I hand painted a Madonna True Blue album cover. The one where she has the Marilyn Monroe hair and the leather jacket off the shoulders. And for some reason, I just wanted to hand paint it. And I was showing it to some friends. And then this guy came over, a guy called Steve, who I'd never met before. He said, did you paint that? And I was like, yeah. So I did it in deluxe paint on the Amiga. And he's like, that's really cool. Do you have anything else? And I showed him the other things. And he was like, you want a job? I was like, I don't know. I work at Safeways. And I work at the grocery store. So, you know, I was working behind the register at the time. But it was very exciting because I guess I hadn't really sort of fully figured out what I wanted to do. And video games, you know, was something I've been playing since I was like 10 or 11.
Right.
I never really sort of put two and two together and thought about like a job in that, you know, until we sort of brought it up. Then I went home, told my mum, and she was like, it's a great idea. And my dad says that video game stuff, that beep, beep, beep stuff is going to be done in 2 years. It's a fad, son. You don't want to do that.
So you're 16.
Look at me now.
You're 16. You have this club. Did you create this club of like?
No. It was a club that was started several years ago. And it was good fun. What's that?
Was that through your school or your high school?
No, it was just a local club. I think they had like flyers at sort of the local, you know, candy shops and things and stuff, you know, like newspaper shops and stuff around the corner. And a friend of mine saw it and, you know, he's big into games too. He got me into it.
So,
and,
did someone come there to like, as like a recruiter or were they coming just to like check out the club or something like that? And they just saw your work there?
No, it was just really a mishmash of people. It was people, you know, playing games. Some people were copying games, you know.
Yeah.
There was a bit of that going back in the day. There was also some demo scene people. I don't know if you have heard of like the Amiga demo scene.
Mm-hmm.
So the Amiga demo scene, for people that don't know, was and it still goes on today, actually. People still do it. People would sort of show off their art and programming skills on a small demo, like a little sort of, you know, technical demo with 3D stuff whizzing around, flowing text and things that you wouldn't normally think the computer could do at the time. And it was a way to people show off their skills. And just, you know, as it so happens, you had a few local video game companies sort of around the area. And some of those people would just come hang out and play games. So, you know, because they worked for companies, they would sometimes see somebody and go, well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Are you working for anyone? You know?
Right.
So
what was that first job that you took in the games industry?
Yeah, I remember it very well. His first job was a company called Ultra Graphics, and it was in a place called Sidcup in Kent. I grew up in Kent in the southeast of England.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my first day. I was like just turned 17, I think, like 17 a bit. And I hadn't traveled that far from home before. So I had to get like three trains
at this point.
What's that?
You're what, like 17 at this point?
Yeah, I was 17.
Yeah,
and
that's crazy.
I hadn't used the trains a whole lot on my own, so I got on like three trains to get there, and I think I was like an hour late. So it wasn't a good start.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but it was a little tiny office. It was the size of like a bedroom next to what you guys are called a realtors, you know, estate agents, as we call it in England. And, you know, because it had no AC, the building was an old building. We'd leave the door open and, you know, we'd sort of see like customers for the realtors coming back and forth, seeing us like coding away and stuff, you know. And just three of us.
What was your position at that first job? Did you have like a title or something you were focused on?
I was the sole employee.
The sole employee.
Wow.
Yeah. Because the guy who had spotted me, Steve Redpath, who's a real sweet guy, I'm still friends with him today.
Cool.
He's an artist, but he was co-owner of the company.
Okay.
And the other guy was a guy called Gary, who was a programmer. So we had Gary the programmer, Steve the artist, and me the artist as a junior artist at the time.
Wow.
That was it. And we did everything.
Pressure? Did you feel a lot of pressure? Like in that, like it's a team of three. Like there must, like you have to bring a lot to the table there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure because we were literally surviving on a shoestring. It was, you know, if a job didn't pay promptly, we were in trouble. You know, so we were basically contract, you know, working for like doing video game ports, like PC to Amiga, Amiga to PC, or even ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64 back in the 8-bit stuff, because that was still thriving around the late 80s. It was 89 when I started, and we basically were sort of like, we'd bid sort of pretty low, I think, to get the job.
Okay.
Just to sort of get some clients and sort of build up from there. But a lot of the ports we did would only take about, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months. I mean, they're pretty quick because they'd send you all the art sheets, you know, all the big deluxe paint, you know, sprite sheets, all the little frames of the guys, you know, running, falling over, shooting, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I would take it into deluxe paint and, you know, I'd be sort of showing the ropes a little bit, like, all right, we need to do this for the early PC graphics cards, which had like 4 colors, 16 color modes, you know. I don't know if you know like PC CGA, but it was like 4 colors, and there was only 2 different choices of 4 colors. They were fixed palettes.
So limited options here.
Yeah. Well, one funny one was we did a conversion of Snoopy and Peanuts, and it was called The Case of the Missing Blanket. And it was already a game out on PC for VGA and I believe EGA already, which was 2 different color modes. And I had to do a CGA one, which is the 4 color modes. And I had a choice between white, black, magenta, and cyan, or yellow, green, red, and black. Because Snoopy's white, I just went with the white palette because there's no white in the palette. But then it was like, it was pink hills, pink houses, and blue sky. And I was like, this is kind of garish. So I switched it to the other one and made Snoopy yellow and got basically in trouble for it because they were like, Odie from Garfield's yellow. We can't have Snoopy as yellow. So you're going to have to put it back to the pink houses. So
trademark disagreement right there.
So it was real challenging back then because you would, as an artist, you would have to come up with ways to sort of like add colors in that didn't exist. So you do stippling, like checkerboard patterns, you know, to sort of like do mid-tones and things and try to like make gradients and different colors out of stuff, you know? But it was crazy.
That's awesome. So your focus, like definitely in this first job, was like on the art side and the coding side. So after this first, how many years were you at this company,
I guess? I was at the company for just over a year, I think.
I have another question. Did you learn to code while working at that company?
Well, I'm not a coder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sort of a technical artist in that I do a little bit of scripting stuff, but I'm sort of more of a script tweaker than a coder itself.
Gotcha.
But as far as like the sort of technical side of art, like, you know, animation, setting up stuff, doing level of detail, doing all the things that you have to do to make games run performant and things to look correct, I do all that stuff. So the position I'm in is sort of a in between the coders and the artists.
Yeah.
So I speak the coder's language a bit and kind of translate it for the artists.
Gotcha.
Because there's like 2 different languages.
Yeah. You know.
No, that's awesome. So after this first year at this company, did you have another opportunity that you got reached out to, or did you reach out for another opportunity, or like what was that next step?
Well, I was basically unemployed because the company went bust. Mm. We didn't get paid for Snoopy. And,
oh, no.
Yeah. It was, again, it was a, you know, we're sort of surviving on like month to month kind of thing. Right. And it fell apart, unfortunately. But we sort of disbanded, but we kept in touch. And then I'd now got the taste for it. So I was like sort of thinking what to do. And of course, this was pre-internet.
Yeah.
So you were going to like the Yellow Pages and trying to find like, there's no search function, Yellow Pages, not the old Yellow Pages. So you're like trying to look for games companies, trying to think if you could find them, you know. Yep. You go to the library and ask about like, you know, is there any lists of companies or is there any, even video game art tutorials, like is there, are any books on like, you know, digital painting? And they were like, I don't even know what that is. This is how long ago it was, you know.
Right.
So, but I did eventually find a list of companies. I forget how I found this list. Maybe my dad found it for me in the end. But I found a list of companies. There was like a dozen on there. I called them all up. And then I got an interview at my next company, which was Argonaut Software. And I went out to them again on the train all the way up through England to south to North London.
Mm-hmm.
I had my little box, a little bag of floppy disks with my artwork on it, and got there. And I remember it being super late for them to finally get around to interviewing me. I was kind of sitting, and it was in a house.
Okay,
it was in a two-bedroom house, and it was weird because you walk in there. And there's people coding sitting on the stairs, people coding in the bathroom sitting on top of the toilet. There's people in the garden sitting on plastic chairs coding. I think it was like a dozen people, maybe less. It might have been like 10 people. And they were just kind of spread out, finding their own little spaces around this little small house, you know?
Huh. Yeah.
It was very unusual because at least the other company I was at was sort of an office, right? It was a small office room. But I didn't think anything of it because I'm still sort of very new. And and they finally got around
like
to
like everyone's doing this. This is every company.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like that back then. It was super weird. It was a lot of companies were basically in people's basements, you know? It was like a couple of nerds in a basement, you know? Which I was one of those. So, but I showed them my stuff. They liked it. But they said that they're not sure about hiring more people just yet. And then I think about a few months went by, about 3 or 4 months, something like that. I called them again. I thought I'd reach out. And he says, oh, actually, we are looking for people now. We did like your stuff. Can you start Monday? And I was like, sweet. Yeah, great. So put the phone down, you know, get prepared. And then I go there on Monday and I get there nicely on time. I'm like good 20 minutes early at least. Oh. Knock on the door, knock on the door, knock on the door, knock on the door. No answer. I'm starting to sweat. I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And then this big Turkish guy wearing a robe comes and opens the door and goes, what do you want? And I was like, is this Argonaut Software? And he goes, what? I said, the games company? He goes, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of nerds. They moved out 2 months ago.
No.
And I'm like, oh, no. And of course, being still pre-internet days, I can't go on my phone and look up their addresses and stuff. So I walk for like a mile, I find a public phone box, call my mum, ask her to go down to my room, find the phone number, because I didn't have the phone number on me.
Right.
And call them, and they go, oh yeah, sorry, we forgot to mention, we moved about half a mile away about 2 months ago, and didn't tell you. So I was late for that job too.
At least it was only half a mile though, right? It could have been.
Right.
Yeah. Worse. It was a little tricky to find because it was along the main high street where there's a bunch of shops. Mm-hmm. And they said it's behind the video store. And I looked around behind the video store and I couldn't really see much. It was like an alleyway with like an old building. And I was like, is that it? I didn't see a sign or anything. Right. I was knocking on this door thinking I'm going to get some other angry person to open the door. But thankfully it was the right place. I found it. So I was like, sorry, I didn't know.
Just some nondescript. Yeah.
So what did you do at the studio as a next job?
Well, that was a long one. That was 7.5 years.
Wow, okay.
That's where we did Croc, Legend of the Gobbos on PS1.
Right.
I remember that game.
Yeah, I was the lead artist on that. And that was sort of end of 95 to 97 when I finished. Then I moved on. But we did a bunch of games before that. One of the first games I was working on was an unreleased game, which funny enough, I actually got to see screenshots of it about 2 years ago, and I hadn't seen this since I was like 18, 19, so I almost, it was very nostalgic for me because I remember painting everything, and I hadn't seen it because it was like a ROM cartridge, a development ROM cartridge that I never got to keep myself. And that was a game, had a sort of weird tentative title called Demolition Dan. And it was an isometric game. Remember the old isometric games? I think people still make them, but you know, it was very big back in the day because we didn't really do 3D much at all back then because we didn't have the power for it.
Right.
And so you'd have a square room sort of depicted in a sort of diamond shape as if it's like 3D and you walk across the room this way, that way kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we were really proud of it. It was actually really good. And initially it was going to be on the NES.
Okay.
And the SNES came out during that development, so we switched over to the SNES.
Sure.
And it was great because you could now do things like transparency on the doors at the front, so you could see the guy behind the doors and things. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, very, very powerful console at the time. And we showed it to this American publisher that sort of basically signed on to publish because they trusted us because we had a good history as a company, even way before I started.
Right.
And they finally took a look at the game in person. They came to visit it. And the guy, he was the first American I ever met. He couldn't wrap his head around the isometric view.
Interesting.
He couldn't see it. Yeah.
Like he didn't think it would take off?
He said, why are all the rooms diamond-shaped? And why is everyone moving around the rooms laying on their backs?
Okay. Uh-huh.
Because if you look at it, you got like this, right? He thought they were just like laying on their back on the floor like this and sliding around. And I was like, no, it's a like you've raised the camera up and you're looking down this way. And he goes,
yeah,
I don't see it. And I was like, oh no. And you know, there have been hundreds of isometric games.
Right,
at this point,
sure.
You know, huge, it's, you know, like head over heels. And, yeah. So it was a real problem. And we were like, well, I don't know what else to do. Cause it's like, we showed them other games and things. And it was like, no, I just don't feel good about this. I just think a lot of people aren't going to understand it. And it's like, it's a really popular format. And then he was like, I think he felt bad. And then he sort of came up with, oh, and the game's a bit dark. I was like, well, we can brighten the colors up a bit.
Yeah.
It's like 10 minutes, you know, just change the palettes, you know?
Right.
And he's like, no, we're going to cancel the thing. So I got canceled. Yeah.
Wow. How many months of work was that, or years of work?
I think it was less than a year. Maybe it was either over a year or less than a year. I forget.
That sucks, though.
And how big
is that
studio?
Proud of it because it was fun.
Yeah.
How many people were working on it at the time?
Two
people.
Yeah, it was myself and the coder.
Wow.
Yeah, Ian. And Ian had designed the game. He came up with the idea and it was fun. And Ian, you know, we're still friends today. He's a very zany guy and he came up with all sorts of weird enemies. It was sort of aboard this abandoned spaceship. Now, it was weird because it had like the sort of sci-fi theme of like, you know, something like an early Dead Space kind of thing without the horror. Just sort of like dilapidated, dark sort of spaceship. You've got to walk around and find the things, right? Mm-hmm. But the enemies were super weird because this was like 91, 92. Mm-hmm, we were still in the old school vein of thinking of like, well, a lot of games had real zany enemies. Like, you know, you'd have like, I don't know, vacuum cleaners going back and forth and scissors totally. And things.
Yeah.
And yes. I don't know if you remember like the old, if you've ever seen like the old retro games from like the 80s. And so we had things like killer toasters. We had like toasters sliding around with like toast sticking out of them. And if they touched you, you got damaged, your health bar would go down.
Uh-huh.
So it was.
This in a 2D format in the 90s.
Yeah, so it was all sprites. It was all 2D, but it was depicted in that isometric sort of pseudo 3D. So you just basically created like tile sets of like diamond shapes to kind of make grids and floors and things.
Interesting. Know. So
yeah.
Okay, so you said you just saw like a demo of that a couple years ago.
I saw two screenshots of it. It was two pictures. Somebody had taken a photograph of their TV set playing the game, and it was the cover screen, I think. And cover screen and a screenshot of the game.
And was that your buddy that you were also working on it with, or was that someone that like
it was another programmer who's a friend of mine. He's gone to do some other things, but he's another programmer, and I think he got to keep one of the copies of the ROM cartridges.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I never thought to ask at the time to get one, because I, you know, when you're doing these things back then, like even when you're working on Croc, you don't really sort of think about, you know, them being successful.
Right.
So you sort of like just go, well, it's just another job, and you sort of move on. And I didn't even like keep some of my artwork handy for like my portfolio or anything. It was like, you know, you just sort of like go, oh, I've done that. And then you sort of go on to the next thing.
Yeah. Was Croc the first 3D game you worked on?
Sort of. So we had, so Argonaut became well established throughout the world, but mostly in Europe initially, as one of the early 3D pioneers. We were pushing 3D very early on, way before a lot of companies would sort of try to get into that. And you got to remember, like back then, it was all proprietary right. engines.
Yes.
So you were writing your own stuff, your own game. There was nothing to base it off of. It was pure
no Unreal.
New code. Yeah, no Unreal, no Unity,
right.
no Lumberyard, nothing. So, you know, and you were doing that for a number of reasons. Firstly, that stuff didn't exist, right?
Right. Yeah.
And secondly, because the hardware was so limited back then, you had to sort of write it 100% focused for the exact game that you're trying to make, right? You couldn't be a general engine. So you if you were doing a game where, like Crash Bandicoot, you're running down a tunnel most of the time, right?
Yeah.
You would sort of do something that has pretty good draw distance, but doesn't need to like focus on a lot of objects outside and can kind of like hone in all the detail along sort of a channel,
narrow
you know?
Path. Yeah.
And, you know, you might want a certain frame rate, you might want, you know, certain like response times and things, stuff like that. So you would sort of cater the engine for that. So to answer your question, we'd sort of done a little bit of 3D before that. I did a game called Creature Shock on the PC.
Creature Shock.
For the CDI, 3DO. I think we did a Jaguar version, which may not have got released. Yeah, the Jaguar version as well. Mm-hmm. And that was a semi-3D game because I did some actual 3D in that where we had, similar to Crash Bandicoot, but we had a tunnel. It was like a trench. We had a spaceship flying down it, and you had sprite enemies flying towards you, a bit like the old Afterburner games.
Yeah, yeah,
and, Afterburner. Yeah, so, you know, the tunnel was 3D, but I remember being told, I don't know if you guys know much about polygons, like, you know, everything in 3D is made out of triangles.
Sure.
The pixel surface. You know, we have games now with just the character model is like, you know, 30,000 polygons.
Right.
We're only allowed 150 polygons for the entire frame, for the entire scene. So you basically had like real chunky polygonal, like old PS1 style, you know, tunnels. And it did like branches and underground stuff and back out and things. And when I was doing all this stuff, people were like, this is crazy. It's not going to work. It's not going to run at a good frame rate. You know? And then I was like, I can make it work. I can make it work. Come on, we can do this. And and then we did it. And it was actually starting to run pretty fast. And it was like, well, this is actually pretty playable. We're getting at least like 20, 25 FPS, you know?
Right.
And then we did everything else in sprites. Even the ship that was the one you're controlling, it's from a third person view. So you see the ship in front of you was a sprite. And what I did was I modeled that in 3D Studio before 3D Studio Max, and then rendered every possible frame that you could have. So like dead on, just above, just below, to the side, to the other side, that kind of thing. So as you move the joystick back and forth, it would sort of like clunkily sort of move around like this.
It's
and kind
playing
of
playing each of those frames.
Yeah.
As you go. Interesting.
So it gave the illusion of it being really high-end 3D, but it was just basically a sprite, you know. And we only had so many frames. It wasn't perfectly smooth. It was a little jumpy increments, you know.
Right.
And then all the enemies, they pretty much just faced you dead on. So you had like sort of like, you know, floating orb things and stuff coming towards you, and you shoot them to get an explosion effect, you know.
And that was Creature Shock?
That was Creature Shock. And it was one of those games where, it was especially big back in the day, games that had like sort of multi-game things in them.
Yeah.
So you had like the shooting section, then you had like the tunnels section, you walk around, and you had like the puzzle section, things like that.
Yeah.
Yep. So this particular section was when you sort of transition between planets and stuff, you know.
Cool. Very cool. So,
and then we also did one last thing. We also did race driving on the Game Boy. That was 3D.
Race driving?
Yeah, on the OG Game Boy.
Wow.
Which could barely display 2D graphics. Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, we did something like 10 games there, I think. Something like that.
Wow, in the course of like 6 or 7 years, you said?
Yeah. Yeah. Because back then it was, you know, you had a quick turnaround, get a game done in a few months to a year, you know.
That's so funny. It's completely different now. That's
The race driving one was interesting because that was a very, very expensive high-end arcade machine at the time in the early 90s, and it cost like tens of thousands, and it was running at 60 FPS with a at the time high resolution screen like 640 by 480.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we had to convert it to something that was like a pocket calculator.
Yeah.
Something that's like this.
Yeah. So back then people were doing a lot of stuff for like just taking it and just doing it as a top-down sprite-based game. But we were like, no, let's do it in 3D. Let's do it in filled 3D as well, not even wireframe. And we did. We got it working. It was like 5 or 10 frames a second.
Still.
Oh my
But
gosh.
it was playable. You could actually play it. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
I guess this is kind of like a weirder question, but at the time you're making these games, right? There's much less press about these games, right? Obviously, there's still an audience of like people that are buying these games and stuff, but now we have like all these huge outlets that are covering
Huge
games like
events.
nonstop. How did you guys like promote that at that time, like promoting those games? Were you guys doing interviews for like newspapers and stuff like that? Like, how did that work?
It was primarily magazines. So, on the news shelves, you'd have tons of video game magazines as the game industry started flourishing. It's from like the late 80s when I started, it was starting to take off again. Because it sort of went through a lull in the 80s. And in the early 90s, it was starting to take off because it was starting to see, a lot of money and a lot more interest in games. Because in the 80s, it was still sort of like you had to be on the fringe to sort of even think about playing a video game. It was sort of like, oh, my friend has one and it's kind of fun. Maybe I'll get one. That's exactly how I started, right? Whereas now it's like everyone knows about video games. It's just a case of do you partake or not, right?
They're so mainstream,
Yeah, exactly. It's changed a huge amount. I mean, it's crazy. And so yeah, to answer your question, it was primarily magazines. If you had the money, you'd do a full page commercial, advert, and it would be typically like the cover image with the big logo on the front, and then little screenshots along the bottom. And
And
it
were
was for
those
like
game
thousand
specific
stores.
magazines?
So you'd have magazines typically specific to particular machines. So you'd have like the Commodore Amiga magazines and the PC magazines and the game console magazines. They were starting to kind of come out, well, they'd already been out for a while, but as those were becoming sort of more popular. So it'd be sort of based on what you had, because most people back then couldn't afford like multiple things. Those consoles and those PCs back in the day, I don't know if people realize, but they were super expensive.
It's a
If
lux
you
it was
look
a
at like
luxury thing.
it was a super luxury thing. I mean, if you look at like old newspaper cuttings of like PCs being advertised, like an old 486 PC at the time, which was brand new, you could be paying like $3,000 to $5,000 for that, and that's back in 80s money.
I
So
know, so that's
even
hugely
more.
expensive.
Yeah, super expensive. But yeah, and if you had a really big hit, then you might get a commercial.
That's interesting. So now we're around 8 or sorry, 96, 97, you said ish, when
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
so how many more games did you do with this company slash did you like stay with them to a certain point, or did you move on? Did you want to do something else, another
Yeah,
opportunity?
we did quite a few. I did Ren and Stimpy Fire Dogs, which was a SNES cartridge game, and it didn't do so well because what happened was we showed it to Nintendo. When you worked for Nintendo at the time, as their they were your publisher, they would tell you, they would sort of, well, I should say, dictate to you which cartridge you got. Did you get like the small capacity cartridge, the medium one, the bigger cartridge? And they gave us the small cartridge, so we're like, oh no, like 3/4 of our game that we developed won't fit on this thing. So we had to scrap so much of it that it kind of made the game a bit pointless. It was sort of like a couple of little mini games, and that was it. It was supposed to be this big story, big, loads of different games in it, and it weakened it horrendously. So some people know of it, and people do still, post videos of walkthroughs and like, let's try this game out kind of thing.
That's cool, yeah.
But it was very hard to work on because the time, especially being a brand IP, Ren and Stimpy was big on Nickelodeon. And we were still on VHS at the time. This was before DVDs, so we had a like a third or fourth generation bad VHS copy of a whole bunch of Ren and Stimpy episodes that we'd slide into the VHS player. And I had to use a scanner, was plugged into the back of the VHS recorder to scan frames of Stimpy
Or
when I'd find an
assets.
episode where he walks along, right? Like, I'm not really a 2D animator, I'm not like a sort of cartoon animator, so I'd have to use reference, and that's what we do a lot in the games industry anyway. So I would get these scans, and then get them into Deluxe Paint on the Amiga, and you look at it, and it's just a smudgy, blurry mess. You can't tell which leg is which. You can't tell where his face is. It's just like a blob.
Sure.
And then you sort of like play the video back and forth, back and forth. You know, have to press all the buttons back and forth.
Yeah, try and find the
right. And then
right
you sort of go, oh, that's his left leg moving. I see his right leg's doing this, and his hands are waving around. Okay, I'll try to paint that. And you paint each frame by hand. Mm-hmm. And then you go, oh, that's terrible. Something's wrong. I've got to do it again. You know? And then eventually you get the character down, and we came up with a neat way. The game has a sort of a mechanic where you're posing as a Dalmatian so that you can work in the fire station because it's Dalmatians only.
Okay.
And Stimpy's a cat; he's not even a dog, right? So Stimpy needs to earn money. He decides in the cartoon to paint himself as a Dalmatian. Mm-hmm. So we had to come up with a technical way to have Stimpy fade from Dalmatian paint all over him with the spots and everything. Being Stimpy again, red and gray and blue nose.
Yeah.
And so I came up with a way of like having two different color palettes, and the black spots would blend away back to a duplicate gray of the rest of his stomach, so that you'd actually have a smooth fade transition of the spots coming back out and back away again. And his red to go to like gray and white as well, like a Dalmatian.
Yeah.
And it was really convincing, and people were like, wow, how did you do that? It was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a fun challenge. And then awesome. we did the world's first, I think it was actually the world's first 3D full-on fighting games. There was a 4D boxing game, I think, before us, which was a sort of a simplistic with like spheres and you kind of punch and stuff. But as far as like a full-on sideways, you know, Street Fighter style fighting game, we did the world's first PC 3D fighting game, which was called FX Fighter. And That was a game that we were influenced by Virtua Fighter, the arcade machine, the Sega arcade. We had one of those at work. We were, I think the boss had just bought one or got a deal on one, and it was a bad idea because I'm sure we lost a lot of development hours playing that game.
That's how it goes.
It was too much fun. I think I had like over 60 wins in a row. It was like winner stays on.
Wow,
I got really good with Cage.
King of the Hill.
Yeah, and it was just... But most of the time I would lose, but I got a lucky streak one day and I was really into it. And I found like a combo that would just kill people. People like hated it. It was like, stop doing that combo, do something different. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right.
And you absolutely know you can't do anything else beside that. You're like, no,
I'm... Yeah, I was like, but it works. I'm going to keep doing it. I'm racking up wins. Cheap wins, but it's fine. But we did a fighting game called FX Fighter, and we had 3D polygonal characters for the fighters, and this is still like around sort of 486 early Pentium days.
Yeah.
And you know, the graphics cards back then were almost non-existent. There was a few, but it was, you know, sometimes it's software rendered using the CPU.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the programmer said, we're just going to do basically a 2D backdrop that just kind of scrolls. It kind of loops and scrolls like a scrolling backdrop, like 2D fighting games.
Yeah.
And I said, no, come on, we can have a 3D arena. We can have something you can fight on. I mean, Virtua Fighter has like a little arena thing so you can do the ring out and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he's like, we don't have enough polygons to do that. I mean, we've barely got enough, you know, to do the characters. Having two characters on screen is way too many. So one night when he went home, I just went ahead and did it. I didn't tell him.
Added an arena.
Yeah, and I basically put in like 3D floor, which is basically like a trapezoid shape, you know, big quad for the top and then slopes for the sides. And I started putting like boxes for pillars and like, you know, a couple of like elements to it. Mm-hmm. He came back in the next day and he was so mad at me because he was, even though I was sort of lead artist and he was lead programmer, he was sort of leading the whole project.
Yeah,
I basically went against him and he said. You shouldn't do that. You should talk to me before doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He said, but let me take a look at it. And he goes, actually, it's not running too bad. Uh-huh. He says, we could probably do it. Just tweak a couple of things just to make it more performant, whatever.
And they did it.
We did it. And I actually went to town with one of the big boss levels. Because we had it. I said, all right, I can do basic animation on this stuff. I can do things like moving, right? He says, yeah, that's pretty easy. I'll just kind of like, you know, program in a speed for something. I says, well, let's have the boss guy fighting on the deck of a spaceship going through a tunnel. Okay. He's like, it's too much stuff. You can't do all that. It's too many things on screen.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, come on, I can do it. So I did like these sort of like little band light things because they were just thin strips of little lights against the black backdrop, which was just basically black screen doing nothing.
Yeah.
And these things scrolling overhead. And then I started adding in ships, which were literally a cube, just kind of sheared to like that, with the front cockpit there and the back there.
Okay.
And I had about 12 of them flying by on a loop. So you get all these ships flying overhead as you're fighting.
Yeah.
Then he came in and saw that, and he's like, "Oh my god, what are you doing?
You can't do this.
Yeah, it's like too many things again." And then he goes, "Oh, but it's not running too bad. All right, we'll keep it." So, I was always a bit of a rebel with stuff like that.
That's how like things become grow or things
that's
become
how you
normal
innovate.
Over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're innovating all this stuff too. This is like things that are unexpected at the time too, which is so cool.
Yeah, yeah, you had to sort of like push the boundaries a bit because you're working with such limited hardware that people were giving you like real low ceilings. Like, all right, I've tested some stuff, and based on what I've seen, this is all we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would go, well, yeah, but that's kind of in a different sort of way of doing things than we're doing. If we sort of utilize this advantage, we can get more on screen, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, like for example, it's a small arena. We're not like moving around far and stuff. You know, we can sort of keep honing the detail on a small area. Doing. And it was very, very reminiscent of the times because, you know, people would come out with games that would just do something nobody had seen before all the time because there's a lot of new ground back then, right?
Yeah.
And that's how you stood out, you know?
Yeah.
You'd have programmers that would come in that were these demo scene programmers that could do crazy stuff that you never thought could be possible.
Right.
And then they would get hired and they would sometimes write in assembler code. They wouldn't even write, you know, using compilers and stuff. And they would just write directly to the machine, which is the fastest direct way. They call it writing to the metal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, come up with ways to do stuff. And it was incredible. And yeah, we did a lot of stuff at Argonaut. I got to watch Star Fox being developed.
That was so
fascinating.
Cool. That is really cool.
Yeah.
Dylan Cuthbert, who's a good friend of mine, he now lives out in Japan, but he was the programmer on that, and he was going back and forth between Nintendo and Japan.
Yeah.
And I remember him sitting in the corner at his desk, and I was like, "Hey, what are you working on right now?" And he goes, "Oh, this is the Star Fox thing you might have heard about." And I was like, "Oh yeah, wow."
Cool.
And I sat next to him watching him testing some stuff out, trying to get like this collision stuff working things.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Wow, this is pretty impressive." I mean, it's everything's 3D pretty much on screen.
Yep.
And it's filled polys. It's not like vector lines, you know, wireframe.
Right. Right.
And it was running at a pretty decent frame rate. And then I was asking him about this, and he goes, "Yeah, it's running on an early prototype of our thing called the SFX chip."
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't know about it. I worked in the company. I didn't know what was going
sure.
on. Because the thing is, we got to quite a big company. You know, we grew very fast. We went from like seven people up to 120 people. And there were several projects going on at once, and you're working so many hours, so focused on what you were doing that every now and again you go for a walk around the studio and you'd see stuff and you're like, "Wow, what's this? I haven't seen this before. This is cool," you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite exciting. And I remember going over to the IT room, and in the corner was one of our game programmers, Carl Graham. He was sat over there, and I says, "Why are you sat over here? Why aren't you upstairs in the games section?" And he goes, "I'm working on the SFX chip. I designed it." And I was like, "Wow." And he had this huge monitor. I'd never seen a super high res monitor back in the day because it didn't exist.
Yeah.
And he had a whole circuit diagram on there, and he was working all the gates and stuff and the transistors and things. I still don't understand it today. And I was sitting there watching him designing a chip.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Wow, this is so cool." And he says, "Yeah, I have a bit of experience with chips and chip design and stuff." And I was like, "Wow, this is really, really awesome." And that was a big boon for our company, because not only now were we developing very fast 3D engines, you know, we had an engine which we called Brenda and B-Render. And we also now had hardware that we were using, you know, developing, because we obviously got some funding from Nintendo. Like, I think what was happening was the SNES was starting to see 3D becoming a bit of a thing. Mm-hmm. And the SNES just really couldn't do it.
I
mean,
no.
You just had the Mode 7 thing with the floor for like Mario Kart and stuff, which was sort of the perspective floor, but it was flat. It didn't do hills and valleys and things.
The whole
so,
camera moves when that happens.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the whole perspective changes. You're not changing the character's perspective. Right?
Yeah, it's really just a big sort of 2D warp effect, you know, that gives you the sense of it being a floor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big job for the company to come up with something where you could add 3D accelerator to an existing console. Mm-hmm. The SNES was very popular, obviously. And yeah. they were like, well, if we can... I don't know. I'd never seen it before, where you buy a game and you get hardware with it. It's very strange.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I mean, that was bigger back in the day when you had things like Duck Hunt, when you had, you know, actual peripherals.
Gun peripherals.
I mean, that was kind of early gaming days. A lot of peripherals, right? You had things like the Virtual Boy. Right. You had things like the Power Glove. All the they wanted to make gaming so tangible. Even like think of Nintendo's ROB robot that like kind of had these weird spinners and things like that.
Trying to expand, how you interact and things.
Right.
I think the tricky thing for us though was that you weren't getting. I don't know if Star Fox was much more expensive having an SFX chip in the cartridge as regular games. I don't know. Something I should look up actually. But if there was an extra expense to pay for the chip. That'd be $5 or $10 on top or whatever, I don't know.
Sure.
You're basically selling them something that doesn't have an extra peripheral. They don't have this, like you say, tangible thing that sort of justifies the extra expense. So then they're like, well, it's just a cartridge in a box. And yeah, it's doing something fancy. It's a fancy looking game. It looks cool, but what am I paying for here, you know?
Right, and it's so, that same thing. Sorry, not to cut you off. Like you see that trend play out even with this new console generation with games coming out at $70 being the new norm, right? And you have these developers who are saying, look, it's a higher quality game. The assets are, you know, there's higher visual fidelity. You're paying for premium experiences. And I can imagine it's a similar thing back in the day as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, game prices are actually very under what they should
be. Right. That's what I perceive from what I've heard from journalists.
Yeah, we just couldn't really raise prices in accordance with game costs, you know?
Yeah.
The reason why that has worked though is because there's more people buying it, right? So you're not bumping it up 50%, but you're getting maybe 50% more people buying it, right?
Sure.
So or more.
Yeah.
Which is probably more the case. So you know, when I started on games, you know, now, the first company I was at was porting stuff, but I guess the first full IPs probably were under $1 million, probably in the 100,000 plus. I don't know. I'm not sure how much they cost. Cause I didn't really have that information at the time. And I was always too nervous to ask like how much things cost, but, but I know like, you know, by 2006, when I worked on Neopets, Pet Pet Adventures, that was a $6 million game or something, I think.
Wow.
And you worked on Neopets. That's awesome.
Yeah, I was the lead artist on the PSP game.
The
Wand of Wishing, and now we're looking at tens of millions.
Yeah,
you know, now some of the games, even on mobile, like the big games, you know, you're looking at tens of millions. I mean,
with huge teams, absolutely enormous development teams. Yeah.
And you've now got more people doing one thing, like this is the team that does all the foliage. We had an entire team back in the day, you know. So yeah, it's very weird.
So maybe this is sorry, not to cut you off, Finn.
There you go.
So generally speaking, maybe this is a loaded question. Do you think that as a developer, you had to do a lot more outside the box sort of thinking in these early days of like FX Fighter, and you're trying to figure out ways to make things work? Then I feel like with the amount of funding the games industry like has with these huge budget games, is there a lot less thinking outside the box? You say, oh well, like I can just do this and get these assets and plug everything in just as I imagine.
Yeah, it definitely has gone that way. What's interesting though is that I got in on the mobile development quite early.
Yeah.
I was doing it around 2009, 2010, which, you know, as you know, early iPhone stuff really couldn't run a lot of stuff, right?
Sure.
It was definitely a thing that was growing and we could sort of see potential in it. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because if you sort of think of it like you're saying, thinking outside the box to get a lot of stuff on screen, trying to come up with tricks, right? Mm-hmm. And then sort of getting a bit more, I don't want to use the word lazy with it, but sort of lazy where it's like, all right, we've got tons of power now. We can just throw everything in there and it just works. Get the game out and not spend a ton of time optimizing everything. You still optimize, but you don't.
Right.
You don't have to like kind of cut it to the bone as much.
Right, you don't have to cut corners and try and figure it out as much.
But then when mobile came along, it was almost like a resurgence back to like the early 90s.
Yeah,
because
okay.
What was happening was a lot of developers were jumping into mobile who didn't have that early experience of like mm-hmm. trying to think outside the box and trying to think of tricks. And
which is where you come in.
What's that?
Which is where you come in.
Which is where I come in, because there was a lot of, like, I was doing contract work for a number of years, and from like beginning of 2009 for a few years. And those contracts were very interesting because they would sort of have this game they want to do, and it's just running horrendously. It's very poor frame rate, just sure. having trouble cramming it into memory, crashing on mm-hmm. devices. Because as you know, like the cell phone, the mobile phone device is a wild west.
Yeah.
Just a billion different devices of different configurations. Yeah. It's an absolute nightmare when you come from the console world, when everyone has the same hardware.
Yep.
So I would quite often get employed in things because I would take the concept and strip a load of stuff out and give them the same visual effect for like one quarter, one tenth of the cost, you know,
sure.
find ways to do it. And then that became a thing. And then now mobile phones have got really good again, really powerful.
Yeah,
so
right,
I think people are now just like getting lazy again. It's kind of a wave. So
I saw a post from Backbone, which is, if you don't know, it's a peripheral for phones. It's just kind of a controller that like you just put your phone into, so you have a more tangible game controller.
Right, and I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it was kind of like a satirical post. I just actually sent this to Vincent, and it was like someone made the jab that a phone can run. Oh, I forgot what game it was talking about, but it can run a game better than a Nintendo Switch can.
Wow.
And I was that's like, crazy. That's crazy.
Right.
Yeah. But thinking about the amount of power that has been allocated to like mobile devices now, and how much of a market that is for, you know, us more mainstream, you know, like, oh, I own a PS5 and I play God of War, you know, and we're up on this high horse. It's just
but
a different
everybody aspect. Has a phone. So there's so
everybody
much,
has a phone.
Right. So much more of an audience right there. You don't it's not
right.
You're not gating it by having a console.
Yeah, right. it's why the mobile, I think the mobile, you know, game scene has become so big is because they know, even though it's a difficult scene because of the, like I say, all the amount of hardware and trying to get it to work across a broad range of devices. Mm. And like you say, everyone has one now. I mean, it's like going back into when I started out and, you know, everyone's got a SNES in their pocket, you know, it's like, you know, you're going to make games for it. Cause it's like, wow, there's literally hundreds of millions, if not more people, you know, billions of people who have these, and it's just, you're going to go after that, you know?
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, when I started in games, it was so small that you're going to laugh at this. A lot of the companies, the name companies back in the day, like Codemasters and things like that, their early days of that stuff was they would make the game, they would print out the tape cassette inlay cards for the tape cassette for Commodore 64 and ZX Spectrum themselves at home. They'd buy plastic cases, put them in the cases, put the tapes in there themselves, mm-hmm. put them in cardboard boxes in the back of their car and drive them around to the game shops and sell them.
No way.
Interesting.
That's what it was like before I started and just right around when I started.
Yeah.
It was a lot of that going on. So wow.
Without a publisher,
how did
self-publish right there.
Yeah.
was your introduction into mobile games what brought you to the US?
No, I was doing... So I moved to the US in 2002.
Okay, so you've been in the US for about 7 years at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Excuse me. Yeah, I was working at PlayStation in London. And I came out in
that's
2001.
Huge. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a really good experience. Started out as Psygnosis, which was part of Sony Computer Entertainment Europe. Which then, as you know, was PlayStation. So I was in that transition. I had Psygnosis business cards, and then it moved over. But I came out in 2001 to the States because the programmer of FX Fighter, who's still a friend of mine, who gave me all that crap
awesome.
For putting shit in the game all the time. Excuse my friend.
No, you're good. Yeah, you're good.
And I came out to visit him and another friend who was working at that company too, both British guys who'd moved to the States in 97. In San Francisco, and then moved down to San Diego because the studio decided to split and have two studios.
Okay.
And they said, yeah, you should come out and visit. I was like, I've never really been to America before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, I traveled through as a little kid when we moved to New Zealand as a kid, but because I was there for a few years, but I'd never seen it. And So I came out to visit them, and they said, by the way, there's actually a job opening here at the company. And they were at, we'd both gone from Argonaut. I'd gone to PlayStation London. They'd gone to PlayStation San Diego. So we ended up at the same company, but different countries.
Oh, right.
And then they said, well, there's a job opening going here. I was like, why would we work at PlayStation? I mean, if I was interested, I guess it'd be a transfer, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And then, so yeah, 1 minute I'm on the beach in San Diego in November. I couldn't believe how gorgeous the weather was. I was like, oh my God. Coming from England, it's like, you know, freezing cold, you know? And then, and then the next minute I'm putting on a suit and, you know, I'm having an interview and got back to England. And my friend Nick, who's the one who posted, I think he was the one who posted, yeah, he did post the pictures of the Demolition Dan game because he was at Argonaut. He was around my house watching TV in England. And I says, I need to give him a call because it's been a week and a half. I should give him a call, you know, in the States. I called them. I was in there for like 10 or 15 minutes, whatever. And then took the job. And then just like that, I decided I'm moving to the States.
Was it a different role? Or was it like the similar role that you were doing in
similar role, which was interesting because I got to see a very interesting comparison of like cost of living sort of near London at the same company as opposed to Southern California at the same company. So, which is vastly different, by the way. You earn a lot more in the States than you do in the UK. so it was a good move. But I went into the living room and I says, hey, Nick, I'm moving to the US. And he goes, what? I leave you alone for 10 minutes and you're bloody moving countries? Like, Jesus, what the hell happens? Like, well, it was a good offer. And he's like, oh, my God. Yep. He says, that's no good. Who am I going to hang out with you? I have to come over there and visit you all the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was kind of weird. So I took like 9 months, got my visa and moved over in 2002. So, yeah.
So around this time, I was reading some of like your credits for games and stuff. And I have to bring this up is in 2001, it says you're in the credits for ATV Offroad Fury, which is one of my favorite games. I love this game on the PS2. It said,
I didn't really work on it.
I
think all I did was I consulted on it. It was across the studio from us when we were working on Neopets. And I think it was after that we were doing the PS3 development because the PS3 was brand new and we were trying to do some tech demos on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was ATV being developed. I think it was actually an external product, but the producer was in-house. And she was, you know, constantly working on the game and you know, arranging for. I don't know if there was like, was there branded music in that? I wasn't a big player.
Totally.
I think she was responsible for making those deals and that kind of stuff. Cool. And I think she had me play it quite a bit, give a lot of feedback, if I remember correctly. I think that's what it was.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that is.
There's some fuzzy patches in there somewhere. Sure. I don't know why.
Blends together. So how many years are you at PlayStation in San Diego?
I was at PlayStation San Diego for 5.5 years and 5.5 years in London, 6.5 years in San Diego.
Wow. So this is like till 2005, 2006 that you're...
No, 6.5 years in San Diego. So I was actually laid off with the recession at the end of 2008.
Got it.
And then that was a bad recession. So, there was a bit of a gap. I was putting out resumes and stuff and then things were very, very quiet. You know, all the companies
that's when I was, you got into acting.
Yeah. It was a bit of a weird, path change there.
How did
How did that happen?
I'd always been curious about it. You know, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, doing like little sort of funny performances, you know, with like puppets and things at home, and I would make puppets and stuff. And my dad always thought it was funny, like the things I would do. And then my mum had looked on in the newspapers for anything that was coming up, and there was a film being filmed near us, and a couple of the kids from my school. I went to the same school that David Bowie went, but obviously 20 years after him.
Yeah.
The same music teacher he used to have. He used to tell us stories about how he was a bit of a rogue at school.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was a Ravenswood School for Boys in Bromley. And I never did it. I never went to any auditions, but I heard some of the kids at school had got these little small roles in these things. It was a local production. I think it was an American production, but it was being shot in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I was very shy, know, and I even tried drama school once at school. I was in there for one day and left because I was so nervous. I just couldn't do it. I sat in the corner and was shaking and I just left.
Yep.
So I never did anything with it. But although having said that, at junior school before that, I did do nativity plays. It was sort of a thing when you were like 7 years old.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had a really funny, bizarre experience that happened that I actually jokingly blame on the fact that that's why I didn't do acting for years. I was playing Jesus and I had this long tunic on and we had a little wooden stage that was about, I don't know, like 12 feet across, 15 feet across something. Mm-hmm. It had steps either side and it was polished wood. It was very shiny wood. And when it came to my first line, I like the girl who played Mary. I wanted to be my girlfriend.
Naturally.
I ran up the steps, trying to impress her. I ran up the steps. I tripped on my tunic. I went flying, landed on my belly, slid across the stage, went down the other steps, and ended up underneath the principal's chair.
No.
And he yells out in front of all the parents, "Mr. Butler, get out from underneath my chair henceforth." I kind of shimmied back out bright red and got back on the stage and did my line.
I got
nicknamed Flying Jesus for years at school.
That's a great nickname.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so I although that wasn't really the reason, I sort of jokingly say that's why I just couldn't do it for another 30 years, you know?
Jesus.
It took me that long to get over it. But no, to answer your question, I just, you know, found that things were real quiet. You know, companies were like saying, look, we're definitely interested in, you have a great resume, you've been doing a lot of stuff, but we're just not hiring right now. We don't even know if we're going to be keeping the people we have, you know?
Right.
Real, real bad. And
so
it was about 4 months into it. And I was like, well, it's getting a bit much. I'm sending out all this stuff and it's not happening. Is there anything I want to do? Because it's like my first break in 20 years of games, you know.
Right.
Is there anything I want to do to sort of keep myself busy?
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? I was always curious about acting. Maybe I should look into it, you know. Because whenever I watch the movies and stuff, I'd always sort of really get into it. You know, I'm a huge movie and TV fan. And I would sort of find myself, this sounds kind of weird, but when I was sort of in the dark watching movies, I sort of find myself like acting out internally, like
the pain, the role.
I'd sort of feel like I was sort of doing that and I didn't even realize. And then I didn't know anything. I remember googling like, what is SAG-AFTRA, what is, you know, what acting schools are around, and you know, I didn't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found a little acting school in San Diego and I drove there and it was literally right around the corner from Sony where I got laid off.
No way.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, this is weird. If anyone sees me here, but then again, it's sort of in a nondescript building. They won't know, but
sure.
And I pulled up, I went up in the elevator. I walked down this dark, gloomy corridor to this door. It's like one of those like multi-office buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to this door that had the little plaque on it that said Actors Workshop Studios in San Diego. And I went to knock and I was like, what am I doing? This is stupid.
Mm.
This is stupid. Why am I doing this? So I went back down, got into the car, drove off. And then I stopped and I was like, no, you should check it out. And that was like the sort of turning point.
Yeah.
And then I went back in and did it. And I was super nervous. And I thought I was just there to watch a class, just to audit it. And they had me come down and do something. And it was, the page was shaking. And I was sweating.
Yeah, so scared.
I was so nervous. And, then I kept doing it and I got into it and I've been doing it ever since. So 12 years now.
That's awesome. And I was looking at some stuff too, like on AMC's Launch 49, that TV show.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. Amazing. There's some other stuff that I saw on there that I was, it's super interesting too, that you went from literally games for 20 years into, did you do auditions for these things or did you start, did you know people around the area that helped you get into this?
Funny enough, a bit like that weird computer club I went to back in the day, I found a local film club in San Diego. And it was like, you know, indie filmmakers, you know, composers, actors, all sorts of people come into this thing. And it was like about, I don't know, 50 people. People sometimes do little sort of like talks and demonstrations and stuff.
Yeah.
And I just sat there sort of absorbing it all and asking questions and meeting people. And I was probably the only British actor in San Diego. So everyone took a liking to me like, British accent, that'd be kind of interesting for my film. Mm-hmm. You know, could you play this part? Could you do this?
Or in the
So I started getting like short films and like I was doing like student films at local schools.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I just started out that way and I was auditioning within a few months. And I got an agent in 3 months of acting.
Wow.
but he was kind of new to that.
Sure.
So not a whole lot happened. like one of my first acting jobs was very strange. calls me up and he goes, I booked you on something. You don't even have to audition. I'm like, really? That's weird.
Yeah, that's cool, though.
You know, it's interesting. Sure. He goes, it's a commercial for a restaurant opening. And you're going to work on it for 2 days, $200 a day, and it's local. It's just a couple of miles away. And I was like, wow, all right, let's do it. It's great. Yeah, sign me up. You know, I was naive. I didn't know. I was like,
yeah.
You don't have to audition. You just get it. That's amazing.
Right.
I thought this thing to do. I thought this interview was supposed to be hard, right?
Yeah.
And then I go to it, and it's a big production. There's like, you know, trucks outside, lots of crew running about. There's multiple cameras.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, well, this is a real legit thing. It's not just some guy with a camcorder, you know. And nobody's telling me what I have to do, or is there any lines? Is there any scenes? Is there anything I have to do? I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a real restaurant. It's like an actual restaurant, and there's customers coming in, like real customers. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'm getting a bit nervous. I'm trying to ask the producer, like, is this something I'm supposed to be doing? Because I'm sorry, I can't talk right now. I've got to run, you know. And he's like, got the earpiece in, and typical. I'm like, oh my god, I'm starting to sweat. And they have me dressed up in these clothes that are matching the actual workers there, like the servers and the waiters. And is another young actress who's also from him, from my agent, who's there. And she's like, I don't know what's going on either. I was just called to come here. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I was told that I'm supposed to be a bumbling waiter. And I was like, well, that's going to be basically no acting required, because I've never waited a table in my life, so I'm going to be terrible. And then she was supposed to be, I think, like, you know, pretty good at it or something. I don't know. And then I don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden, the producer grabs my shoulders and pushes me out into the restaurant floor and says, go serve. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Oh, and by the way, they showed us, they only gave us 5 minutes to look at how to use the point of sale system where you're typing in the orders and stuff. And after 5 minutes, I had no clue what I was supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I go out there and I'm like, you know, sort of, all right. And there's a camera following me all the time. And I'm like, okay, hi, how are you doing today? Can I get you anything? I'm trying to think of things, you know,
a waiter would say.
I'm like, and then they're like, oh yeah, can I get this drink and that drink? And I'm like, okay, what is that drink? Like, you don't know what it is? Like, oh God, it's like, this is so embarrassing. And then I'm just like shrinking and the camera's just following me all the time. And then I realized I didn't have a corkscrew. I had to ask another waiter, and he's like, oh, you better give it back to me. And he was kind of pissed off, you know, and I couldn't open the bottle of wine very well. I had to get the customer to do it. And it was such a nightmare. And it was like 100 people in the restaurant. It was so busy.
Gosh.
And then the owner of the restaurant, the actual owner of the restaurant, comes over and she's getting mad at me. She's like, this order was late and you were doing this and the camera's on us. And I was like, what? Oh my God, I'm in a reality TV show. Not a commercial.
Oh my God.
I realized that in mid scene while the camera's on us.
Yeah.
There's probably a moment where I go, you know, like this. And then I thought, okay, in that case, then I'm going to have some fun. So then I was like, yeah, but I told you in my interview that I do have experience. I never had an interview.
Right.
That I worked at McDonald's for 3 weeks. So I have experience, of course, saying something really stupid like McDonald's, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, McDonald's? You worked at McDonald's? This is a higher restaurant. You shouldn't be working here. And she's getting mad at me. And then the camera goes away and she goes, that was great. Do more of that shit. And I was like,
this is the biggest plot twist I've ever heard in my life.
This is insane.
I love
it. Now I was starting to enjoy myself. And then I was like, and they give me a plate of food and they say, walk out through the center of the restaurant. There's a little opening there.
Mm-hmm.
Drop the plate of food and go, oh no, I'm so sorry, you know. So it was like chicken and nice vegetables in there, and I walk out there, I do a little trip and I drop the plate, it smashes, and everyone goes, oh my God. And then the owner comes over again and she's like, oh my God, what now? You've broken this plate, you know, you dropped this expensive dinner on the floor, the whole thing. And I said, I think the chicken's still okay. I could dust it off in my apron and put it back on the plate. And she goes, would you feed your dog chicken off the floor? Because my dog always eats chicken off the floor. I don't even have a dog, you know?
You're making it up as you go.
Yeah, so just like improvising, having never studied improvisation.
Yeah.
And then I went over to the table that was the first one that was serving me. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, sat at the table was the owner's mother.
Of course.
And she was really mad at me because I was terrible. And she thought, why did my daughter hire this guy? Because she didn't know I was an actor.
Right.
And because it was an opening day, an actual opening day. Mm-hmm. Oh, and she also got mad at me before all this happened because myself and the actress were told to wait outside and then we'll get brought in when they need us. And she was like, she came in and she says, why are you guys standing outside? Why aren't you helping get the restaurant set up? She was actually mad at us, for real. Right.
Then
at the end, she kind of liked me because I was this weird, quirky British guy. And then she said to me, she said, what is a British guy like you doing working in a restaurant out here? It's very strange and unusual. And I was like, well, I just, the camera's on me again. I was just trying to make up stuff. And I made up a really stupid story about how I'm really bad at booking flights and I just booked a one way and now I've got to earn my way back.
Oh my God. Yes.
Wow. Like you could even work like as a visitor without a work permit. Uh-huh. It was a really stupid story. And she was looking at me very confused and she was like, okay, dear.
She's ate it all up.
And I was actually genuinely hungry because they didn't really have much crafties available and we were kind of running around. Uh-huh. And I just found myself, I guess, looking at the plate of like, you know, cheese and crackers and things. Uh-huh. And then she goes, do you want some, dear? And I was like, no, I probably shouldn't. I'm going to get in even more trouble. So I didn't take any.
But the thought was there.
and then I got back and told my agent, I said, dude, come on. That wasn't a commercial at all. I told him what happened. He goes, I'm so sorry. I said, did you do that on purpose just so that I'd look like a fish out of water perfectly for the role? Because you don't have to do that to me, you know?
Right.
So yeah, that was one of my first things.
That's insane.
Did you keep him as an agent?
What's that?
Did you keep the agent?
For a bit longer, but it didn't go for very long.
No, I can't imagine it did.
Yeah. So I did acting in San Diego for about 2 years. And then I was driving up to LA all the time for auditions. Mm-hmm. It was like a 110-mile each way commute. I was doing it for like 3 or 4 times a week. And my car miles were just racking up.
Absolutely. Yep.
And eventually I just thought, all right, I'm going to move up there. I'll rent out my house and just move up and just give it a go. So I've been in LA now for 10 years.
Wow. And what's like some of the stuff you're most proud of that you've worked on recently in the last
Lodge 49, years? Definitely.
Yeah.
Because that's a big network show and it's
right.
a wonderful show. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it got cancelled after 2 seasons, but it only got cancelled because it just didn't have the outreach that it could have had because it's a very quirky, whimsical show. Mm-hmm. It's not very mainstream. You know, when you sort of try to describe it to somebody or you show snippets or a trailer, it doesn't really tell the whole picture of it. And it's actually a wonderful show, very imaginative, very charming, tons of heart, tons of character. And
for those of who are watching or listening who are not familiar with the show, could you give like a little brief description?
It is hard to describe. That's the thing. It's initially a story, and it's sort of the main arc through the first 2 seasons of a character called Dud, who is he lives in Long Beach, and he's the sort of very sort of stereotyped sort of, you know, bleach blonde, or not bleach blonde hair, but sort of, you know, sun blonde hair, surfer dude kind of dark guy. He's sort of a young dude from Lebowski, Big Lebowski kind of thing.
Sure. I love it.
People draw a lot of, you know, sort of similarities to that, but he's quite different when you sort of actually watch the show. But he's, you know, he's sort of just wafting through life, just kind of floating around, and he's on the beach with a metal detector and he finds a ring. He picks this ring out of the ground and he's like, well, this is interesting. What is this? It's got an interesting little symbol of like a sort of a griffin lynx kind of thing on it. Mm. And then he's driving around town and his car breaks down right outside this building. He looks over and he sees it has the same symbol on it. Mm. And it's one of those sort of, you know, strange sort of fraternal, like, you know, kind of the Masons, kind of Freemasons kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He goes inside and sort of goes into this very unusual world because the writers of it often told stories about how Long Beach has a lot of like buildings that are very unusual that you wonder what actually goes on in there. It's like it's got a logo, a thing on it, but no one really knows goes on in there. And it's sort of the curiosity of like what goes on behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And they have their own charming little sort of community and people sort of, they don't really live there, but they spend all their waking hours there. They have a pub inside, they have games, they have things, activities and stuff. It's a place to belong, you know, and he's never really had a place to belong. His father went missing and him and his sister have been sort of dealing with it in their own ways. Him very lost, still looking for his father, his sister sort of being very realistic and saying we should move on. He's gone, you know, he went out surfing, never came back, you know. So it's about him sort of connecting with this very strange dusty old society in this thing, and then it gets more and more whimsical and he starts discovering more and more about the history and the magic of the things that go on and have gone on since it was around in the 60s. My character was from Lodge 1, which was the first lodge in London. It's my accent for that working well for it. Uh-huh. And it was a whole story about sort of the flashbacks, the beginnings of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's awesome.
It's a wonderful show.
Yeah, it sounds delightful.
And you're like a reoccurring character both seasons, right? For that show?
No. I was just in one episode.
Yeah.
Okay. But it could have become a recurring character possibly if it had gone on.
Right.
It just, you know, with the amount of content out there now, it's, you know, shows have to fight for space. You know,
totally.
It's quite tricky. And it was it had some wonderful talent behind it. You know, the dub was played by Wyatt Russell.
Yep.
Paul Giamatti exec produced it and also starred in the second season. Mm-hmm. I had Bruce Campbell in it. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's awesome.
Fantastic people, and
so
there was a ton more story to tell. I mean, even at the end of season two, huge cliffhanger.
Yeah,
and you know, as you know, there's just hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of shows now, and it's just you're trying to fight for that space. And you know, it really connected with people that sort of liked things that are different, that sort of wanted something a little different, not just watching the same old, you know, guns and explosions and crime dramas and all the stuff that's out there. So, it's, I hope, fingers crossed, someday that it gets resurrected.
Yeah.
It would be lovely to see the continuing story of that.
Right. No, that's super cool too. Just like even the experience, right? It's an AMC show. So it's like, it's a big network show, big names on it too. So besides Lodge 49, is there any other like things you're like super proud of acting in the last few years?
Or anything we can look forward to?
Yeah, look forward to also.
Yeah, well, our mutual friend Luigi, who is responsible for this, I worked with him on something. That's how I met him.
Uh-huh.
And I can't say too much about it because it's not released yet, but it was an amazing experience. I've been getting into creature performance of late. I've sort of connected this sort of thing of like, well, I've done animation in games, so you start out with a character doing this, and you pose him and make him walk around in a volume, and you know, with nothing there initially, and you sort of have to create something from nothing. And I realize there's aspects in acting that are like that. Voiceover is like that. You're in a booth, but you're a crazy squirrel from the south who's fallen off a cliff or something, you know, and you got to create a voice for that. Or you're doing mocap or green screen, and you've got to kind of work in a void that doesn't exist. And the same with creature performance. It's you are often working in an actual environment, like I was on set for this film, but you know, you do have to create something from nothing, and that was an amazing experience. And it's quite unusual. When you guys see it, you'll be like, oh, that's you doing that? That's weird.
That's
hot. Yeah, because I auditioned for a film a few years ago and booked the role, and it was sort of like akin to like, you know, Leatherface from like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of I don't want to call it a creature role because he's a human character, but he's very, very deformed and has a lot of stuff going on with him. Mm-hmm. And the audition for that was the craziest audition I've ever done in my life. It was 15 minutes of improvised, you know, aggression and violence and cowering and and I thought, wow, that was really fun. I want to do more of that. So I started doing classes with a guy called Lauren Eric Salm, who was one of the last students of Marcel Marceau, the mime artist.
Okay.
And got into that. So I started doing a little bit of mime and creature performance, and that's what led me into this role. That's how I met Luigi.
That's so cool.
I want to continue that stuff. I want to get more into it and, you know, have that sort of as an added thing. Because I think in acting, you've got to kind of find... Yeah, you go out for the broad stuff, but you also got to kind of find a niche, a thing that you're good at that not everyone's going to be doing, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. So you can be more sought after, whatever it is.
Right, just in a less saturated market.
Just when those things come up, it's like, oh, he can do that. We don't know too many people, so you might have a shot at that, right? So that's something I'm interested in. I take some of that experience doing that back into games, and I take some of the experience in games back into the acting, and it kind of feeds each other, you know?
So you're back doing games and acting right now.
I never really stopped doing games, to be honest with you, because within about I think about 6 or 7 months, I started doing small contract games for work.
Mm-hmm.
But I was now starting to do the whole thing of juggling acting and games. It was around like sort of mid to late 2009. But these contract games are very short. They were like 2-week things, and you would sort of bust them out, and then you might do another one a month later.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just sort of started to figure out in my head, like, am I the sort of person who can multitask two different careers at once? Because not everyone can do it.
Yeah.
No. A lot of people, it's tough. It's like you either devote yourself to one or you don't, you do something else, you know?
Right.
And I thought, no, I'm actually a multitasker. I could do this, I think.
Yeah.
As crazy as it sounds.
Yeah.
So I went without a full-time job for a few years just to kind of give it everything.
Yeah.
And there was a thing too. When I started this, I was 36 turning 37. Mm-hmm. And quite a few people were telling me I'm way too old to start acting and it's not, mm-hmm. nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
So wow. I'm stubborn. I wanted to prove them wrong.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's awesome.
You know,
there's always people writing stories that need characters of all ages.
Right.
It's not like you can.
It's true.
Yeah. There's
not everyone in a show could be young.
Exactly.
Well, I think their angle on it was there's plenty of people that are at your age that have more experience than you that are more likely to get the role because they have all these credits and stuff.
Because they've been acting since they were in that young person role.
Right. Because, you know, almost, I would say 9 out of 10 actors that I know are doing it to some capacity since they were teenagers or younger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm the only one I know who started it super late. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of this weird person because I go on sets for things. Here in LA, obviously a lot of Hollywood stuff.
Yeah.
And then Lodge 49, which is out in Atlanta, which is now a very big film industry. And
yes,
very much so.
And I turn up on set and I'm just this sort of normal guy who works in games.
Yeah.
I'm not like a very actor-y actor. I get into it. I do. I totally love it.
Yeah.
But I'm not sort of like, you know, I'm generalizing here, so apologies.
Of course,
everyone's totally the same.
Right.
But you do get a lot of people that are sort of very sort of focused in on the acting world and they sort
of that is their persona.
Yeah, sort of way about them, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm sort of like, you know, sitting there like having a laugh and, you know, looking at video game stuff on my phone and and then I'm like on set.
A little bit
like,
of both.
That's so cool. I love that.
So
I try to keep it sort of pretty balanced, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finn, go ahead.
I really want to get into some Avatar stuff before before we start wrapping things, closing it off. But so you've been working on Avatar Pandora's Rising for how many years now?
Almost 6 years.
Wow.
Five and a half, yeah.
Tell us a little bit just about your experience.
What's it been like working on an IP that huge? Just
one of the biggest
game
IPs.
Development.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. When I started with the company, it was called Kabam at the time, and it was late 2015, and I was on Marvel Strike Force for about the first couple of months.
Which is so cool. Yep.
And I told them in my interview that I do not write shaders. I'm not really a programmer.
Okay.
And they were like, that's totally fine. That's totally fine. Don't worry about that. We just need a lot of help with Unity and all that kind of stuff. I was like, that's good. I'm very, you know, done a lot of Unity stuff. And then day one, they said, can you write a shader? I was like, oh no, I told you I can't write shaders. And I'd moved back to LA. I was living in Vegas for a job. I was at Vegas for a company, a games company for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I didn't want to let them down. So I just got my head down, put some music on my headphones and just thought, all right, how the hell do you write shaders? Because they are so difficult.
Yeah.
Even, you know, experienced games programmers don't want to touch shaders. They're like, that stuff's black magic voodoo stuff. Right. I don't even want to touch it, you know? And I started grabbing shaders off the internet. I started like trying to like see if I could logically figure out what thing does what.
Mm-hmm.
Pulling them apart, sticking them together, duct taping different shaders together to make this really like, you know, very complex shader for Captain America, the first model that we had.
Mm.
And he had to have like, you know, reflections and,
right.
you know, sort of, you know, non-reflective parts. And I even gave him like a bit of a sort of skin shader. So there's a bit of a glow to it that kind of gave that sort of the illusion of subsurface scattering, which is a technique we're using in rendering, which is becoming more popular in real-time games. And, I did it. I made it work, but it was really hard. It probably took me like 20 times longer than a experienced, you know, programmer. I did it, and then I was working on a thing called Crime Boss, which was a game that didn't continue through. And then they're like, "Well, we're doing this new thing. We think we can get the Avatar license, and we want to work on that. Can you come help us with that?" So I started working on that. I think it was at the beginning of 2016, and.
Wow.
And then it was super early, and I was doing like crazy tech demos on my phone. I would sort of do like, what if you could take like World Machine you know, like actual fractal landscapes, and then bake those out and then have that on the phone. And you could zoom, pinch zoom all the way into like a hut with a Na'vi standing next to it and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was doing that and I was showing people and they were like, this is crazy. You got that running on the phone? I was zooming in and showing them like all these like clouds going overhead with cloud shadows rippling over the things. And
yeah.
And then they were like, wow, this is cool. And then they were like, this is probably not the way we're going to go, because we're going to go for more of a sort of like a strategic, like,
sure,
world map thing.
Right.
And then they changed that. But it was, we just kept working on it. And it was a very sort of experimental game. Yeah. It was a bit unusual for me, because pretty much every game I worked on, you had a very clear understanding of what you were trying to make at the beginning. Right. Like, you would either have an actual documentation, you know, a GDD, game design document, or you'd have somebody sit there and explain it, or you'd have something maybe already part developed you could look at and go, we're trying to make more of this, you know. So you always have a really good idea. With this, it was, you know, I wasn't very particularly experienced with 4X games. And for me, it was, I still don't really play them that much. And I was like, okay, so you got this element, you got that element, you got this crafting thing, you got this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just trying to sort of figure it out as we go along. And also they were figuring out as they were going along, because they were like, we know sort of what we need, but we're not quite sure how it's going to function yet, you know,
right,
and how it's going to look and what kind of camera angles we're going to have. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it was quite difficult, because I'm sort of very like structured. I like to sort of know how things are, especially as I was the one who was helping with, like, you know, file naming and you know, project layout and all that kind of stuff, like how you're going to structure the files and keep things tidy and what things go where and how people can sort of access stuff. But it was very difficult. But, you know, on the plus side, it was enabling real sort of sandbox creative thing where people could just come in and try stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I had to sort of like adapt to that.
It's a creative environment too. It sounds like people were able to show what they thought would be good and like show what they can do to bring to the table too. That's a cool environment to work in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, working with a big IP like that, of course, that sort of brings its own challenges, because
absolutely,
you know, you're taking something which is a very, very rich, visual, detailed world,
right,
that typically gets displayed on a big screen. Right.
Right.
And then you're trying to shrink that down to, you know, 5+ inch phones, you know, because we were going back to like iPhone 4S and stuff like that. It was small screens. And you are zoomed out too, and as you've seen in the game, and you worry about like readability and noise and you know, things being too small on screen, and can you tell what is happening, what where the characters are and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
You know, you've got a load of blue guys running around in a blue and green and red environment. You know, it's tricky. So you're having to do certain sort of like stylistic choices. Not that I was involved so much with the stylistic stuff, but I was involved with sort of helping with that, that sort of style, with the art director trying to define that. Because, you know, initially we sort of wanted a very rich game that looked a lot like the movie, but it just doesn't work on a small screen.
Right.
So, you know, you have to kind of like pull it back and sort of go, what are the sort of the main fundamental things that you need here?
Right.
To retain the look of Avatar, but to so that people don't get confused what is happening, where to click.
Like, when I've seen like some screenshots and stuff that you guys have up on the website and all that, and it's like an art style that is like adopted, but it still looks like Avatar, but it's its own kind of style. And so it's successful in that, at least. Like, you know, when you see it, you're like, okay, cool, that's like Avatar. Yeah,
it's its own style to sense, but obviously, you know, with any game, you're looking at reference of other games that have worked in that sort of format, you know, with similar camera angles, similar devices that are coming out on. You just have to. I mean, you don't want to keep reinventing the wheel every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you make your own wheel, you make it your own wheel, right?
Yep.
You know, it's round, but you've got to make it your own. Mm-hmm. So, so looking at all those other games and looking at, you know, the stuff that's worked in the past and sort of like understanding like, oh, I think I see the reason why they've done this. My feeling is that it's because of this choice, right? It's because of readability. It's because there's a lot going on in this particular scene. It's because of the camera distance. You start to sort of figure out why people made certain choices, and you can sort of learn from that. And then, but the game itself is extremely original. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that is, you know, very influenced by the IP. You look at the Avatar world, and it's like there's things in that world that you can just, it's just fantastic. They translate so well to games.
Right.
And so, but it's definitely been a, you know, a challenge ongoing to sort of figure out how to make all that work, you know, how to sort of appease the IP, to appease, you know, Lightstorm and everyone else involved in the movies and the franchise, and have something that, because I've worked on IPs before with like Ren and Stimpy and Harley Davidson and Snoopy and all sorts of stuff. And you do sometimes have issues where you as a game developer are adapting something to a very different medium, not only a different screen size, but also interactivity that wasn't there before, and like how games work and things like that. And not always do the IP holders understand what you're doing. They look at it and go, why doesn't it look like the movie?
Right. And you know? That I was going to ask too, because Avatar, as we know, like have so many, they're filming these like 2, 3, 4, 5 movies back to back to back. They're doing all this stuff. Yeah. I'm sure they have a big vision of when they want something to release, like to coincide with the movie or something, however that's going to work. And so do you guys, like, if I was a developer doing this and I was putting months and months into like a certain thing in this game, and to have like the IP creator say like, oh, like we can't, you guys can't do that in the game. Like that must be crushing. I'm sure there's like plenty of things that they tell you guys you can't do.
Yeah, you definitely, that definitely does happen. Although I will say that working with them has been fantastic. I mean, they've extremely open-minded.
Yeah.
I think it's actually, even though it's one of the biggest IPs I've worked on, I think it's been one of the easiest.
Wow. That's
still cool. Have to like obviously run things through them, but it hasn't been sort of like those sort of, you know, difficult partnerships where you're sort of struggling to sort of have them understand things, you know? They're very, very, very experienced in all forms of medium. And, you know, of course, they've had games from when Avatar first came out, so they've been there, done that, seen it, right? Uh-huh. So it's not like some of the other IPs where this is the first game being made of their IP and they're sort of trying to get their head around it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's been really good. It's been a really good experience, but, you know, the reason we've been working on it so long is because it's a very big game.
Sure.
And you have to get it right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big team, it's a big game, and there's a lot of moving parts, and you're constantly sort of refining things and trying to get everything working just right so that every part of it feels good and has a good, you know, retaining interest from players throughout the game and, you know, through the progression of it, you know, building up. So.
And so like, I don't know if you guys even have answers to these questions yet, but will it be like on Steam or Switch or anything, or is it just like app iOS store, Google Play?
It's just on iOS and Android. I don't think there's any plans to do anything else. But you know, it's been put out there in limited countries. You've seen it's out there in a few countries as sort of a beta test.
Yeah.
And you know, we still haven't done a worldwide launch yet because we're still refining the game and getting it perfect.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we have time for the films. The film's obviously been sort of moving a bit, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's been a bit of leeway with that, which is good. But yeah, I'm very proud of it. It is quite difficult sometimes, I will say, when you're working on a game that is not the genre that you typically play. Mm-hmm. That sometimes can be tricky. Because you obviously invest everything into it. You give it all the passion that you would with anything else, but you sort of have a bit of homework to do. You have to like pick up other 4X games, start playing those, and you know, State of Survival, whatever else, and start getting into those, and you know, trying to kind of get on board with it and understand it enough so that all the input that you have into it has the same amount of direct focus and value that you would have had with something that you really are passionate about, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you're into fighting games, you make a fighting game, you're like, it's got to have this, it's got to have that.
Right.
It's gonna,
you know,
it's
exactly be what to look for.
So it can be a challenge. Yeah. I still do play a lot of games, but yeah, there's certain genres that I haven't, because I'm busy juggling two things at once at the moment.
Yeah.
Certain game genres that I haven't got into, and some of them, you know, are huge time suckers. So.
Right.
You know, I remember years ago, somebody like saying, this is even before I got into acting, he was like saying, you know, you should play World of Warcraft. It's like, nah, man, I see people getting into that and they just come out. Yep. You know, it's like, exactly. I don't know if I've got time for that. It's like, it's not a good idea.
Luigi has a question for you in chat right now. He says, do you know when the game will come to America?
I can't but, say yet.
That's
all being worked out, but sure. We're obviously working towards that. But when there is a public announcement, you know, I can obviously say that. But yeah, we're definitely working towards it. We're just trying to make it the best thing we can.
So, and then I want to start moving toward wrapping this up, but I have one last question, and it's a bit of a fun one for me.
Yeah.
Is, do you have a sort of dream project? Is there one IP, one franchise that you would love to work on, or maybe an original project?
I'm really into VR at the moment.
Ooh.
And James, I actually,
I'm a big VR guy as well.
Yeah, I've got my Quest down here. And I actually, funny enough, got to dabble a little bit playing around with very, very, very early VR helmet that we were developing at Argonaut back in 93, wow. 94, something around that time. Around that, I think it was around that year. It was either between 93 and 95 or something like that. And no, it would have been pre 95 because it was using the Super FX chip and
plugged
into an SNES. Plugged into an SNES, and we had a ribbon cable coming from the cartridge into a helmet. Mm-hmm. We had two 320 by 240 little LCD screens, pixels the size of trucks. Yep. And when you moved your head around, it had like pretty bad latency and everything, but it was a glimpse into the future.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, wow, this is weird. This is like, you know,
that's so that cool.
Nearly 30 years ago now.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, when VR started picking up again, I've always found that I'm somebody who likes to escape, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's why I like acting. It's why I like games, because you get to escape into other worlds. And I like, you know, when I watch I'm a big fan of horror movies. And when I watch a horror movie, I want to turn all the lights off. I typically want to watch it on my own. I want to get scared.
Yeah.
I want to freak out. I want the adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
I'm kind of weird like that.
No,
I want the
I'm
whole
same
experience.
Way. Yeah.
So, you know, when I put VR on, I'm like, I want the whole feeling. I want to feel like I'm there, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so to answer your question, a VR game, I've actually started developing years ago I did, not while I've been working here at this company, but years ago, I started working on my own VR game solely, entirely myself, doing the music, sound effects, dialogue, the acting, the animation. The programming was done in Playmaker, which is visual-based scripting, because I'm not really a programmer.
Yeah.
But it's a way of, because I understand the logic of programming, I'm just not really good at the syntax.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And it works. It's a full game, and you can play it from beginning to end. It even logs your scores on a network high score table and stuff like that.
No way.
What's that called?
It's got a work in progress name, which I can't use. It's called Ricochet. I found out there's a game by Valve called Ricochet. Dang. But it's just a work in progress name. Nice. It's not anything I've released or hasn't been continued on for a few years. But it's still there. I just mess around with it just to kind of learn Unity more.
Totally.
Do you think there's any chance they'll get a public release?
I may release it someday. Yeah. Okay. I find myself in a position where I'm not working contractually for somebody, I might get back into doing it again. But you know, I'm pretty busy at the moment. But it's I might release it someday if I find myself in that position.
That's
but
awesome.
It was a great experience though, because I was working on it before I joined Kabam, which is now Scopely Boundless Entertainment. You know, they needed Unity, somebody to guide them because they were very new at it. And working on that game, you really threw yourself in the trenches because you're like, I've got to figure out everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Not just like one aspect, like, all right, how do I build
every
a prefab? How
thing.
Do Yeah, you have to figure out everything. How do I trigger sounds? How do I put music in the game? How do I do collision? How do I do projectiles? How do I do physics? How do I do all this stuff? And, you know, it's sort of your own trial by fire, you know?
Right. I mean, I'm sure you're learning so much, though, through that process. Like,
right.
Yeah.
And I imagine that helps you work better with the people in those roles for whatever project you're working on. You know?
Yeah, it does help. I mean, although you sort of tend to like focus on a certain area of the games that you work on, you do find yourself sometimes every now and again, like just, you know, at someone's desk and they're like, I'm having trouble making this work. And it's like, oh, you know what? I think if you use this component instead of that, that'll work. And it's like, well, that's random. How do you know that? You know? So that does, that does happen once in a while.
Totally.
It's also fun just to know those things, because when you see the game running in Unity, you know, you get to kind of see all the stuff running and you get to kind of like look in there and go, I understand some of this, and I'm learning some other things that they've added in because they've gone deeper on this than I used to go, you know?
Right.
So you do learn a lot. It's fun using an engine like that where you can see all the nuts and bolts working while it's running.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have messed with Unity at all, but it's a fantastic piece of software. Mm-hmm. And you really can see everything running while the game's running.
Yeah.
You can sort of like click on assets on the scene view and see them animating in the game and stuff. And it's pretty mad.
That's awesome.
That's incredible.
That is so cool. So before we end, I have a couple speed questions that we get to go through. Okay. This is going to be fun. Okay. So here's what we got. Number one, how many consoles do you own right now?
Oh God. Speed? I can't do speed. I got a lot. I'll try to name off quick.
Okay.
OG Game Boy, 3DS, Wii, GameCube, N64, two PS2s, two PS3s, PS4, a Quest, two gaming PCs, ZX Spectrum 128K, and there's probably some other stuff I've forgotten.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, out of all those, what's your favorite? I'm
big into PC games now.
Yeah.
I was always a console kid, but I will get a PS5. I have PS5 accessories bought for me for my birthday. I still haven't got a PS5 yet. They're a nightmare to get a hold of.
They're just so volatile.
I know. Right, I've got the headset and the camera, and I've got no PS5. And I'm like, So I'm still trying to get one of those. Yeah. But I'm liking PC just because I love the Quest with the Link. You know, you can play high definition, you know, good looking AAA games. Half-Life Alyx is the bomb.
Oh my gosh. I want to play it so bad.
Awesome. What an awesome game. So, yeah, I'm loving that right now.
Yeah. So, okay, out of all... What's your favorite game of all time?
Oh, my God.
Of all time. If you had to go...
I know, it's a very hard question.
I'm a massive fan of the Zelda franchise.
Yeah.
So, for me, it would probably be going to something like Majora's Mask. Ocarina of Time got me into it, but Majora's Mask has that extra darker element to it. Mm-hmm. I love that. I want to play that again. I still have my N64 under my TV.
Yeah.
And I've got it with a little HDMI hookup now so I can get a better picture. And I'm like, I want to start playing those old school games.
That's cool.
That's good. What's one of the favorite games you're playing currently?
I'm playing GTA 5 in VR.
Nice.
No way.
Using that Luke Ross mod. They need to release if they do, when GTA 6 comes out, they need to add VR to it because it is insane in VR.
You love it, yeah.
I love it. It's just madness. When you drive off a cliff, you feel that in VR. It's mental. When you're causing chaos through the city, you feel it. It's
how do you drive?
I have a race seat.
Sat
on the race seat with the steering wheel and the pedals, and the steering wheel shakes when you go over stuff. It actually has vibration in there too. Whoa. So when you go over like train tracks or bump into something, when you're walking, I take my hands off the steering wheel and pick up the controller off my lap and walk around. In VR, you can look around while you're doing it. And then you jump in a car, you hit triangle, jump in a car, go back to the steering wheel, get your feet back on the pedals, and start driving around.
That's
so fun.
It's awesome. Wow. And I've got Red Dead Redemption 2, which is a fantastic game. And there's also a VR mod for that, and I'm tempted.
Wow.
No way.
Yeah. Racing wheel on the horse.
Yeah. Steering wheel with the horse.
Yeah, just down here. Yeah,
that's so
trying
cool.
to do handbrake turns in the horse, you know.
So I thought this was an interesting one that I kind of skipped over earlier. But there's so many big IPs out here. If you had to work on a game for any IP of your choosing, what IP would you want to? Star Wars.
Star Wars, and acting too. Star Wars games and acting. I grew up on it. I am a huge fan of Star Wars. I still back in the UK have 120 vintage Star Wars figures and toys and stuff in my mum's attic. If she hasn't thrown them away, I don't know.
Yeah, but, God willing.
I love Star Wars. I just love it. I'm more of a fan of the OG trilogy, but you know,
of course,
The Mandalorian is fantastic. It's such a good series, and I'll be honest, I was a little bit trepidatious, like a TV series of Star Wars. I don't know, and then everyone was raving about it, and I just finally decided to get Disney Plus, and I was like, oh my God, this is great. The passion they put into this, especially coming from, you know, from Dave and John Favreau, to do the, you know, original feeling Star Wars with the, you know, very a lot of practical effects, but also using obviously the volume thing, but a lot of practical effects, is stunning, and it feels like original Star Wars to me.
It does.
Yeah.
So Star Wars.
It's awesome. It's so cool.
Big time.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for sitting down and talking. I feel like we could have gone on for hours. Like, I have so many more questions, but it was so cool to talk to you and just get a feel for what you've been up to.
Yeah, you've been absolutely incredible.
Yeah, where can people find you, stay updated, like socials, all that good stuff?
Yeah, sure. Most of my stuff is acting related, but I do post a lot of video game stuff, like Croc Legend of the Gobbos, which is probably the biggest game that I've done outside of Avatar. A lot of people still reach out to me about that. Like, is there a remake coming? Are we doing this? And all this kind of stuff. Yeah, so yeah. I do kind of combine stuff on my social media. So I do post up things like concept drawings from the original Croc, you know, things that a lot of people hadn't seen. So my Instagram and Twitter is at Scott Butler Act. That's ACT, Scott Butler Act. And actually my Facebook too. You can plug that in there for the main page.
Cool.
And my acting website, if you want to check out my crazy acting stuff, is scottbutleractor.com.
Awesome. Absolutely. And underneath, if you're watching this on YouTube, in the description, we'll link all that stuff. If you're listening on audio platforms, there will be a link to the YouTube where you can see all that. And social media, when we post it, we'll have all the links too. So that'll be easy to get connected there, which is awesome.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for wanting to be on. It's just, I had such a great time. It's always cool.
Yeah.
So Twitch, thank you so much for watching live. We super appreciate you guys. We are going to sign off, and we will see you guys next week for two new podcasts. And that's it. James, you got any closing words?
Don't forget to follow us on Twitch. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube. Don't forget to like this if you're watching on YouTube. Don't forget to leave a review if you're listening to this on audio platforms. Every little bit helps, guys.
Yep.
Again, thank you so much, Scott Butler. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
All right. Peace out. Yeah.